and welcome to A Vague Idea. This is a comedy trivia podcast. I'm Nate Regolia. Each week, we subject our guests to a list of topics to find out if they have a vague idea. And this week, we are joined by two phenomenal authors, both of whom I've had the pleasure of publishing at Space Boy, which is my side gig that you guys might hear about in the after-show bumper over the closing theme song. But these two gentlemen have also written just a number of other books, and they're just really important thinkers. I think I admire both. What I'm going to say is I'm going to get this out of the way. I know I'm going to load this way too much, and then it's going to be embarrassing. But no, I admire both of you for the fact that as I have turned more toward progressivism in my thinking over my late 20s to 30s, sort of. The last 5 or 6 years that I've sort of had you guys on the radar, like I really admire the fact that you guys are representing what is important and you're vocal about it. And it's not, it's not controversial. It's not silly. It's not like, oh, we have to do outlandishly goofy things. It's like, no, all of this is practical. And we should do them because we should serve the people with our government and with our society rather than, you know, corporations, et cetera. So with that extremely annoying preamble out of the way, I present our first guest is Brandon Goetz, the author of Lars Breaksface, Werewolf in Space, among other things. Brandon, how are you?
Doing well, man. Hanging in there.
Yeah. So welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
And have you
because this is the theme of the show, have you protested? Did you protest during kind of part of the Black Lives Matter protest? Have you protested lately?
Yeah. We made it to one protest. There was definitely a lot of worry about COVID going out to crowds. But luckily, people were really masked up and being, you know, aware of that spread. And I know that there have been studies done showing that hasn't contributed to the spread, at least here, so that's been good.
Now, have you heard about the very valid 2 or 3 people who said that has to be a conspiracy because that can't be possible and everything's been made up?
I haven't, but I would definitely believe them.
Yeah, of course you would, because, I mean, 2 people disagreeing with thousands of other people, totally reasonable. Our other guest is William M. Brandon III. William is the author of Welcome to Spring Street, which is the newest book released by Space Boy, and it is all about protesting in Los Angeles in 2013 as it's connected sort of to the Occupy movement, I believe, at the time, but it is a, like Beauty and the Beast. It's a song as old as time itself. So thank you for being on the show, William. How are you?
Thank you, sir. I'm doing well, man. How are you?
Yeah, good. You know, it's another day in the dystopian hellscape in which we live, where disease and secret police run rampant.
The grand redneck apocalypse.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. I love the part, and I know this meme has gone around a lot, but I love the part where it's like, hey, all you people who were like, I need my gun so in case the government starts arresting people without saying anything, and then they're not doing it because they actually want that as long as it's people that they want arrested. So that's cool.
It's pedantic, but they're really just saying the particular government that fell between Bush and Trump.
That's right. Which happened to be a black man who was president.
Happened to be not incidental. Yeah, not incidental whatsoever.
William, have you protested lately?
So I don't know if I would count it. We went downtown here in Athens the night that they brought the National Guard in. So we went down to support, but we didn't stick around for it. My hardcore protesting was mostly back during Occupy. It went down 6 blocks from where I live. So not only did I feel compelled, it was right in my face. And, you know, the amping up, especially downtown at that time, it was, the beginning steps of a really brutal gentrification process. So, under the guise of tamping down a lot of protests, the downtown police forces amplified immensely. And then they started, in keeping with today, or the Keystone Cops type of concept, they created the neighborhood ambassadors. which were basically deputized private people walking around tasing people from bicycles.
Which is insane. It's insane that
completely insane.
Like, it's insane that this is just a model that everybody, and honestly, like, this is not a new model. This is a historical model. I mean, the origins of the police force were in, hey, my human property ran away.
Can you all
hop together as a posse and go get that person back so
my
that
property.
They don't get, yeah, yeah. I mean, but that's all the thing is, and just beat up anybody who gets in your way on the way there. It's fucking nuts.
Asinine. Yeah.
Thank you both again. I have not also in a really qualified way protested lately, mostly because of COVID concern, but I've done a lot of with my dollar protesting. So, you know, one of the advantages to being stuck inside and also, you know, I don't know, just not having the opportunity to go to bars or anything. I have a little bit of extra money around. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to give to a lot of these causes that matter. And that's, I think there's value in that too.
Absolutely.
That's so legit. Hit up the bail funds.
Right. Yeah. The bail funds, you know, the Council of Indigenous Peoples that's actually here in Longmont that's been helping Native American tribes deal with COVID as well. Trying to hit it on all sides that we can. So let's get into the opening question, guys. This is going to be the first time that you're going to be scored, so get ready. It's time to dish, because you're both writers, and your fiction kind of directly or indirectly deals with the lives of outsiders and resistances. So I'm going to start with Brandon again, and we'll just say, what draws you to that subject? What draws you to outsiders and resistances?
Oof, man. I mean, I've always been... I guess an outsider myself. You know, I grew up in very rural Pennsylvania and did not feel like I belonged there. Did not get along with the rednecks, et cetera, that I went to school with. And always identified with the people who, even if I didn't know this terminology at the time, the people who were oppressed. Looking at, you know, the racism and sexism and things that were rampant and still are in rural Pennsylvania and other places, obviously. I just didn't like that and felt a kinship with them and hoped to fight the power to make things better.
Right on. And yeah, and storytelling is a great way to fight the power and try to make things better. I mean, or at least it's the place where we have an infinite amount of power, because on the page you can make anything happen that you want to.
Damn right.
That you might not be able to make in real life.
Amen to that.
So yeah, William, same question. What draws you to the subject of outsiders and resistances?
So mine is two-pronged. The first part, the first one is that I grew up in a military family. My dad was Air Force, retired after 22 years. So being an outsider was kind of where I lived. Mm-hmm. I went to 4 high schools. I went to a different school pretty much every year of grade school. So that was kind of a paradigm that I lived in. So instead of being kind of a shelter from experiencing other people and sympathizing with them, that was the way I grew up. And then the other kind of turning point was, you know, circa 9th grade, I got into punk rock, right? I started listening to Dead Kennedys. I started hearing words and names I'd never heard before. And then I heard about anarchy. And I'll be honest, when I first heard about it, I was intrigued because it was the opposite of everything, right?
Sure.
It was it was basically saying that we don't need all these things. So sometimes I reverse engineer, I'm in software, that's the nature of the beast. So I kind of went from that premise that I was interested in the concept, and then over time educated myself. And that's what opened up my great respect for social justice movements and forced me to do research, you know, on things obviously that I had not been taught about, and to really discover that this gigantic thing that everyone is so terrified of is really actually the simplest line through, you know, to have a peaceful and cooperative society.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to solve a problem, you get rid of the biggest offender, right? Who kills the most people on this planet? Our governments, right? So they need to go first, and we can figure out the rest after that.
Yeah, it's interesting to approach the problem not with how do we just weave the existing, or how do we convince the existing people that they should cede power, because that's almost impossible.
Never without a fight, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it just doesn't. I mean, yeah. You always have revolutions that lead to the ceding of power, right? Like the French had to literally decapitate most people in their power structure just to get to a point of like, oh, cool. So we can strike, and you'll listen to us now. Okay, cool. Yeah. I love that. Very, very good. Very good. 2 points for each of you for the opening question.
And I thought you were going to say we're both wrong. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I you know.
You're wrong.
It wouldn't be a properly anarchical game if I claimed to know what was right and wrong. You're both right for answering. That's the answer.
Chaotic neutral. I appreciate that.
Yeah. That is the alignment of this game. So we're going to go into round one. And William, we'll start with you. Do you have a vague idea about, and I'm gonna, if I butcher pronunciation here, I apologize. Teek Quang Duk. Do you have a vague idea about Teek Quang Duk?
I'm only guessing. Is that the gentleman that stood in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square?
That is a good guess, but that is not correct. No. Brandon, do you have a vague idea about Teek Quang Duk?
Nope.
Feel free to make something up if you don't know.
I mean, I want to say it's a Cambodian or Thai resistance fighter, but I really have no
idea. Okay, very good. I'll give you each 0 points. Teek Quang Duk is the monk who set himself on fire in the iconic protest against the Vietnam War. He's a Vietnamese Mahayan Buddhist monk, and he committed self-immolation on June 11th of 1963. So since neither of you scored any points, here's an opportunity for each of you. William, self-immolation as a means of protest, what do you think?
Extremely powerful. I mean, that image even made it to the cover of the Rage Against the Machine album in the mid-1990s. That's staying power, you know. Personally, I prefer non-death methods of accomplishing our goals, but we are constantly combating so much propaganda and so much falsification of what's going on right before our eyes that sometimes, you know, a giant protest or self-immolation is the only way that people pay attention, and it's tragic that someone would have to go to that, you know, extreme. It's interesting you mentioned that. I just read an article a few days ago. I didn't know this, but he didn't set himself on fire. It was a group of monks that staged it, and it was very much on purpose, to make that kind of a widespread point. I'd never heard that before. I thought that was interesting. It kind of changed the setup of it, you know, and made it, you know, not just someone's single desperate cry, you know, but a unified message.
Well, in the level of sort of honor and community in that act too, to be like, okay, I'll be the one who goes, and we're doing this together. I mean, because to be present at that takes a certain amount of clout, right? Like to be the person who's doing the lighting. I mean, there's a lot of weight right there. I mean, how do you live the rest of your life knowing that you did that? I mean, regardless of knowing that you did it for the right reason. Brandon,
only hanging on to the hope that it actually worked, right? That's how you keep living. Yeah,
I think that's the biggest thing, right? Brandon, what do you think of self-immolation as a form of protest?
Yeah, man. I mean, I agree with William in that it is a very potent and powerful way of sending a message. That said, and this isn't to take anything away from his sacrifice, but I also think that there is a lot to be said for staying around and still fighting for the cause. I think that personally, that would be my goal, would to be, continue fighting.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, we always need bodies, right? Like that's kind of the whole thing is we, because as William noted, like we're always confronting propaganda and misinformation.
Yeah, it's huge, like, right.
The more people who are around who know that it's false information, who are continuing to push against it, is really to everyone's benefit. So,
right.
Yeah, very good points. I'm gonna award each of you 1 point for your follow-up answers. And I had another thought, and this is gonna be a bit of a reach, but can we make a parallel between the woman who in only a gas mask and I think a hood or a beanie, who was completely nude in Portland? Can we make a parallel between that individual act that was extremely bold and extremely vulnerable in front of this group to this sort of self-immolation that monk participated in? I mean, do we think it's kind of a similar sort of thing? It's like, well, no one would do this. Why would you do this? And that's why it was effective, because it was so boldly outside of our normal scope of understanding.
Go ahead, Brandon.
I would say, like, I definitely hear that, and it was a powerful statement, and you know, she didn't know whether she would survive that encounter or not, right?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot, the bravery in knowing that, like, okay, I'm going to go out here, and if they could just, like, rubber bullet me to death.
Yeah.
Like, who knows?
Right.
Or pull you into a van. That's kind of their jam
yeah.
these days.
Yeah. They're all about renting from Enterprise.
A nude woman being dragged into a van. I'm sure that would be great.
Right. Well, she terrified those patriarch thugs, though, I'll tell you that. They didn't know what to do.
They did not.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a real vagina in decades, right?
I just like the idea that there was some sort of overpowering cognitive dissonance between their like dick swinging militarism and the fact that, like, oh, I'm not supposed to hit a girl, and she's being as girl as she can be.
Yeah.
So I can't do anything now, because I can't even pretend like she's an anarchist. She's just a naked lady, and I've got feelings now. I'm conflicted.
But it's you know, I think that's a valid parallel for that reason. It was shocking, you know, and that's what really sucks. George Floyd's death helped a lot of people I know really stop and think about it. It was so shocking that it's, you know, a monk setting himself on fire as well. It's so shocking that you really do have to stop, and you have to consider this person is either just completely insane and this means nothing, or they were so desperate to change something that they sacrificed their own life. You know, that's usually when you get people to stop and listen. You know, the people who are putting themselves, their freedom on the line in Portland and around the country, you know, it's the same thing. Even jaded people have to stop for a moment and think about the fact that, you know, these people are doing this solely to try to help out their fellow Americans. And to me, that's an incredibly powerful statement.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of this too comes from the three of us here have all been readers our whole life, to some capacity. So I know that reading some of the dystopian fiction that you know, it came out in the 40s or whatever, but like Brave New World and 1984, both books about people making incredible sacrifices for the good of society against, you know, indomitable odds. And those resonated with me because they were about this very kind of thing. We're really at a point of how many minds will open and how many minds will stay closed. And I sure hope a bunch of people's minds will be open and voting at least for the Band-Aid, and then we can actually start working on diagnosing the disease.
It's interesting you brought up those two books too. You know, one is a very dark dystopian concept, you know, incredibly repressive, and 1984, of course, and Brave New World, to me, was super interesting because it does
the utopia for the most part until you get into individualism.
It's the more dangerous oppression, right? Because you feel and operate in a space that feels free, when in reality, your participation is what's holding you back. Plus, I thought it was brilliant that he, you know, had Native American populations being the only people who had not participated in the new society. You know, they were the outland and the outcast because they weren't drugging themselves into bliss.
Right. Which, I mean, that's what capitalism demands, right? We're all like, capitalism is a shark, and if it stops moving, it dies. So we're all just things that eats along the way. There's like five people who get to ride the shark, and they're all riding it now. They're having a great time. Yeah. Yeah, the rest of us are just getting eaten.
Stimulants to work harder and narcotics to go to sleep at night so you can do it again.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to go into round two. And for round two, Brandon, we'll start with you. Do you have a vague idea about the Haymarket affair?
Yeah, that was, I do believe that was a labor strike that was then put down violently and a bunch of people got killed.
Yeah, that
is Haymarket Square, and Haymarket Square is in Chicago, maybe?
Yes, ding. Very good, very good. Well done, that is correct. William, can you add anything about the Haymarket affair?
Sure. It was a bombing that, whether accurately or inaccurately, was blamed on two local Italian anarchists who were subsequently hung. Mm-hmm. For all intents and purposes, from the hindsight of history, it seems incredibly probable that the attack was not orchestrated by those two gentlemen or anyone outside of the actual police paradigm.
I'm going to be a dick and interrupt you, but is this the Sacco and Vanzetti thing?
Yes, that's precisely what it is. Yes, sir. Good job. Get that man an extra point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very good.
I mean, I only got it because you said that.
Hey, you knew Chicago, man. Extra points. That ended up being, just like the self-immolation, it was a massive message to everyone. It was a shocking, they hung them in public. You know, this was a shocking thing. Do not push against this or you'll die. Mm-hmm. In that part of the century, you know, not that anything has changed, but there was a very specific retaliation against any social groupings, you know, unions, anything that could produce, you know, a modicum of power, you know, against the upper classes. And, even today, it's beaten down, you know, people are killed, their lives are ruined, just to make sure that they think twice before they stand up again.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think most recently there's a Netflix documentary called American Factory that I don't know if either of you guys have seen it. Have you seen it?
No.
I recommend watching it. It's about a Chinese firm comes in to reopen a factory in Ohio, I think. Don't hold me to that, but they come in to reopen this factory, and it's basically sort of the narrative of like how one, because in China, people have even less expectation of rights as workers than we do here. And it's not like we expect that much. But it's sort of the story of these workers kind of coming to terms with that, how their new Chinese ownership is going to treat them. And then there is an element of trying to unionize and the conflict that creates and the fact that there are, you know, in the present day, people who are paid hundreds of thousands of dollars just to go around convincing people who work places that unionizing is bad for them.
Yeah.
Through all sorts of histrionics and you know, just, hey, if you got enough fancy looking PowerPoint slides, you can make anybody think anything.
Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah. Great job. I mean, the Haymarket affair, which is also known as the Haymarket massacre, the riot, the Haymarket Square riot, took place in the aftermath of a bombing during a labor demonstration, May 4th of 1886 in Chicago. It began as a peaceful protest in support of workers striking for an eight-hour workday. An eight-hour workday that we have today because people died in this situation. An unknown person threw a dynamite bomb at the police as they acted to disperse the meeting, quote-unquote. It always seems like someone's doing something. I know in Denver here, when we were in the thick of the protests, for George Floyd, you know, there was a lot of backlash, and I got to give credit to Denver at very least for saying, hey, okay, no more using tear gas or rubber bullets because you guys are nuts. But their big thing was, well, a couple of guys threw water bottles at us, so we had to shoot.
That happened in Pittsburgh too.
Yeah,
same.
And it's
bullshit.
Like, what are you doing? I mean, you can't just go over and like pick the water bottles up and grab those two guys and then read them their rights and take them okay.
And you're wearing body armor and have a machine gun,
right?
And, yeah,
you have you have a riot shield. Like, if a water bottle hits you, like, I'm sorry,
a water bottle is not going to hurt you through your military helmet, ass.
That's,
yeah. you're gonna bounce back. You're gonna bounce back from the trauma. Great job, William. I'm gonna give you 3 points. Brandon, I'm gonna give you 2 points because you did drop those Italian names at the last second. And as an Italian myself, I have to respect it. So now we're going to go into our very first game. It's time to play a variant of Fuck, Marry, Kill titled Dabble, Enlist, or Nah. And this is going to be all about revolutions. So William, I'll start with you. Are you going to, here are your options. The American Revolution, the French Revolution, and the Russian Revolution. So which one, if you're going to dabble, you're going to fuck that revolution, but you're not, it's not a long-term thing. If you're going to enlist, you're on board. And you're not going to participate. So what are your choices between the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and the Russian Revolution?
American Revolution, nah. French Revolution, I'll enlist. And Russian Revolution, that's a dabble.
Yeah, I think that's very good.
I think that conceptually it was in the right place, but they made the same mistake as most 20th century revolutions, and you know went straight to protecting the revolution instead of really truly applying the notions that brought the revolution about.
Very good. Yeah, I think that's kind of the point. It became a little more emphasis on brutality and seizure of power, and a little less about sharing that power, which is probably the best thing about the French Revolution, is they managed to sort of do a good thing. It's been pretty successful.
But it brought Napoleon. So, that one's a toss-up. But yeah. I 100% endorse, the Paris Commune and everything that led up to and followed that. I'm a heavy enlister for that, for sure.
Right on. Very good. Brandon, what's your choice on that, on those options?
I mean, all that's totally legit, and obviously, I'm right there with you with the American Revolution. No, thank you. But I'm gonna dabble in the French, and I'm gonna enlist with the Russian. Not because I'm endorsing necessarily what it became, but I want to imagine that I was there to help steer it to actually live up to those ideals instead of fucking up in all the ways that it did.
Right. Hey, just keep Trotsky in the country, brother. I feel like that was Lenin's Achilles heel, is he got afraid of Trotsky.
That was definitely a problem.
Okay. Great work on that. I'm going to give you each 2 points because I think you're both exactly right. And that's what matters. The point is that you would have participated in some form of the French Revolution. And you both passed the test of, would you participate in the American Revolution? And the answer was no. I mean, the best answer is not really in this form, guys. We can think this out a little bit more, can't we? We've got a lot of money, and we're all supposed to be really smart. So let's come up with something better.
Well, not a revolution, more of a rebranding, right? So, I mean, what I take issue with is, one of my favorite protests was Shays' Rebellion. Right after the Revolutionary War, people took up arms because they were being overtaxed and thrown in debtors' prisons. And those are exactly the things that King George was supposedly so offensive about.
Oh yeah, it's funny. It's funny how the very things that are always the like, hey, that's the reason we're doing this. Now we're going to do it, but because we're doing it, it's okay.
Totally, that's how that works.
It's funny how that always works. Yeah, great work on the Fuck, Marry, Kill, Dabble, Enlist, Nah. Let's go into round number 3. And so, Brandon, do you have a vague idea about the Salt March?
Salt March? Fuck, man. Nope.
All right. William, anything? Do you have a vague idea about the Salt March?
Salt March. That's the long walk down the physician's hallway after they tell you that your cholesterol is too high, isn't it?
I like that answer. but no, the Salt March is it's also known as the Salt Satyagraha. I've picked some tough pronunciations, and I hope I didn't butcher it. It was an act of nonviolent civil disobedience in colonial India, led by Mohandas Gandhi. The 24-day march lasted from March 12th of 1930 until April 6th of 1930 as a direct action campaign of tax resistance and nonviolent protest against the British salt monopoly.
Nice.
So just
a salt monopoly. I didn't know that.
It's not a square on the American version of the board game, but yeah, it's definitely one in other parts of the world. You buy
I'm
the
ready
British.
To get a question about sisters. Can we get a sisters one?
Since you recently studied up. So yeah, great job on that. Zero points each. I'm very sorry, but I did like the cholesterol reference. That's a lot of fun. I mean, you know, we're all gonna be there at some point where it's either not enough salt or too much salt. But it seems like salt actually really dictates most of our existences.
Salt and sugar. Those are our two frontal lobe reactions. You know, our most immediate reactions.
Yeah. We need that fuel. We need that spark. Something to let the neurons connect.
And prevent leg cramps apparently as well.
Very true. So now let's do round number four, and William, we'll start with you. Do you have a vague idea about SOS, also known as Save Our Sons?
I do not.
Okay.
No, Brandon, no idea.
Save
not
Our
even
Sons.
Everything clever.
I'm pretty sure that's an anti-war effort, to save, you know, an anti-draft effort. But as far as which war, whether it was World War One, World War Two, or Vietnam, I'm going to just throw one out there and I'm going to see if I get a point or not. I'm going to say that it was Vietnam.
I believe that is correct. It is basically just an anti-draft movement. And it was started and centered around the Vietnam War. So yeah, very good. That's kind of, you know, we have all sorts of ways of protesting. Sometimes it's just protesting on other people's behalf. I mean, it's always protesting on other people's behalf, but sometimes it's directly connected to like, hey, don't kill my kid, please.
Yeah.
This time, just for once. So great job. Brandon, I'm going to give you 1 point and William 0 points. And now,
I deserve that.
It's time for the Thunderdome. And this week in the Thunderdome, you guys have to decide between two famous protesters who would win in a battle to the death. I know it's unfair to pit them against each other, but we're going to go with protester number one is Jane Fonda, Hanoi Jane herself. And the second protester recently came into the spotlight. He has portrayed Finn in the Star Wars sequel trilogy, John Boyega. So, William, who do you think is going to win in the Thunderdome?
It's absolutely Jane Fonda. She has unbelievable stamina. You know, so as long as she can miss a couple of right hooks, I think she's going to win the bout.
Yeah. I think, you know, one, legacy of exercise. Two,
right.
she's been starring in her own show. Last year. Yeah. I mean, Grace and Frankie, great show. And she's 80 something and still going. She's picking up, you know, Peter Gallagher as a paramour in that show.
Didn't you guys see Attack the Block? John Boyega all the way. He's
nice.
Going to knock her out. didn't he just tell Star Wars to go fuck themselves?
He did.
Oh, he
and
did?
I really
yeah.
admire him for that.
Come on.
Yeah. Like, there's no way that I'm going to do another Star Wars movie. And honestly, I don't blame him because it's a poisoned well as a,
yeah.
I mean,
as a thing
is.
To experience.
It absolutely
like,
is, yeah.
You know, I think people can probably write plenty of books, and I'm sure that like The Mandalorian and there will be other shows that will be fine, but like being in a movie now that's a Star Wars movie is not
it's
a good
so
thing.
Toxic
yeah
absolutely.
No matter what you do, yeah, very good. I mean, I think that obviously this is going to be a difficult fight. I think on one hand they're not really gonna want to fight each other, so there's gonna have to be a lot of motivation there. Someone's gonna be prodding them. You know, it's going to come to a point of desperation, whether it's just after day 15.
They're going to form an alliance, and they're going to take down the establishment. That's
there you go.
What it's all about.
Yeah, they're going to hold their signs up. They're going to get the entire Thunderdome crowd to turn against the
Tina Turner.
Against Tina Turner. Yeah. They're going to take Tina Turner down.
Hey, we all saw that one.
So, yeah, great job. I'm going to give you each 1 point for that. And now, from the makers of Pomme ou Pomme de Terre, it's La Chose Française Arbitraire. That's the arbitrary French thing. And the only thing that's French about it is the name. So I'm going to pose a question to each of you. And you just answer it however you feel is right. It's arbitrary. So Brandon, what is the, and I'm throwing air quotes around the word that I emphasize verbally for the listener. What's the right way to protest?
There's no right way to protest because property damage and graffiti, fighting back if you're being tear gassed and batoned, et cetera, those are all legitimate forms of protest. And all the people who claim that there's a right way to protest and that MLK only wanted peaceful protest and all of these things, they really just want a protest that they can ignore.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Well said. William, what's the right way to protest? I mean, come on.
Incessantly and without end.
Yeah. Very good.
So I agree 100% with Brandon. There is no right way. However, there are some very helpful tactics. People have been learning a lot from protest movements around the world. There was just a report that the head of the DHS was befuddled because the people in Portland showed up with leaf blowers and started sending the tear gas right back at the police, and they didn't know how to react to that. So if you're paying attention to any of the protests, especially in South Korea, they really have it down pat. The coordination, you watch the videos of their coordination, they have hand signals and they put up barriers, and it's really, it flips the paradigm, right? Because it's the protesters controlling the police at that point instead of the other way around.
Yeah.
And you know, the kettling of the protest, the minimization is just like Brandon said, so that you can ignore it. And pulling as many people as you can out of the protest and threatening them with a felony and a couple of days in jail, you know, is typically the recipe to turn someone from a protester into a, you know, an idle bystander.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. It is, because ultimately we're talking about controlling the narrative, and you control the narrative through action, right? Like a leaf blower controls the narrative of the evening, which is do whatever you want. We're going to send it back at you. It doesn't matter. But it's also, you know, it's also things like just showing direct solidarity and making sure that everybody's, like you said, incessantly. One of the things that always comes to my mind when I hear the, like, you know, there's a right way to do this, it always seems to ring to the same thing that generations of the establishment men have told women, which is, well, you know, you have to do things the right way to avoid being assaulted or whatever, right? Like, to say no is the most simple and basic form of protest, and yes. it's one that we have a legacy of ignoring just constantly, like with showing zero regard for it as valid. So to imagine that if no is not enough of a protest, that anything beyond no is somehow outlandish and outmoded or something is insane.
Well, the good thing, not the good thing, but the thing to remember is that question has never been answered, right? The people who constantly say this is not the right way do not provide the correct way, right? Because you can't kneel peacefully.
Right.
And you can't burn down the fucking police station, you know, so there's a lot of space in the spectrum between those two. And every time someone chooses something new, it's the wrong way. Right.
Oh,
because
sure.
Ultimately,
you can't block traffic.
Nah. Well, ultimately, the only right way is to sit still and behave. Right.
Right.
That's the narrative.
Yeah. I mean, I it seems to me that the right way is to call someone and air your grievance. In the waspiest way possible, right? Like, you're not, don't be upset. Don't show that. Yeah. Just write the letter. Cause the other
ask
end of this
manager.
Is like a lot of the protests that have gone on this spring have been largely peaceful groups of people who just are standing around. And then it's like, hey, you guys have to disperse now because we said so. And it's like, no, actually we're constitutionally allowed to stand here for as long as we want. Okay. Well, we're going to attack you then, which doesn't seem, I mean, and that seems fairly clear that that's what's going on. I don't know how you even dispute it, but of course it's disputed.
The presupposition of power, I don't remember who said it, but there's a quote that the core of government is to secure a monopoly on violence.
Right.
So the entire idea is, you know, from that mindset is that the police are well within their rights to beat and abuse us, because they have a monopoly on that power. But of course, if you turn that back around and beat and abuse a cop, you're looking at a pretty long haul in the old clink.
Oh yeah, well, you're going to be painted as as an anarchist, even just like spray painting on a federal building, apparently, because we've been doing it for too long.
I mean, violent anarchists are only guilty of spray painting some shit on federal buildings.
Yeah, it's like, oh, God. And it would be funnier if it weren't so terrifying.
Yeah.
Great.
A public building, right? That we should point out. That I think, you know,
again, all of us own.
Don't we all own it?
Yeah.
We all paid for it, right? So, I mean, that gets lost in the mix too, is this presupposition that there is an ownership that takes place, you know, by fiat because of, it's the government. And that's American ignorance, right? I mean, it's never been the way it was supposed to be, but the concept is that we do own that. And, you know, anything to the contrary is a violation of that compact.
Yeah, I mean, I think you really hit something hard, which is American ignorance is kind of the root of most of the problems that we have, whether it be understanding of what the Constitution means, whether it be understanding history, whether it be, you know, comprehending that places around the world that offer some baseline of care and service, a floor below which a person cannot fall to their death, is somehow those people are much less free. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you guys have traveled a fair amount, and we've, you know, I've been to Europe and stuff. And it's like, no, everybody's pretty much able to do everything that I would want to do here. They just know that if something happens to them, they're not going to, you know, be in debt for $80,000 because they broke their leg.
Like, right.
You know, they're free to take chances sometimes and live fully. It's funny how that works.
The irony there, I wrote this in an essay in high school. I did not understand how someone could be a devout capitalist and not make sure that every worker in the country was well fed, well cared for, and did not have any serious injury or sickness, right?
Yeah.
That's how you keep your work line. That's how you keep the products coming, you know? So this deleterious concept that we strip everything down, you know, to do or die, you know, if you don't have these little green slips of paper, you're just going to die. That diminishes your workforce, you know, so that gives a lie to all of it. You know, no capitalist would treat their citizens like this. No real capitalist.
Oh, yeah. Well, the idea that any real capitalist would also be like, well, let's just kneecap most of our demand because we don't actually need them. We would rather focus on capturing these, you know, 100,000 people. We'll make sure they have all the money and we'll just kind of screw everybody and that'll work. And we'll also expect to somehow grow exponentially every single year. It's like, no, you would grow constantly if you just did, you know, demand
people
side
had
economics
money to buy shit, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of the thing with the whole pandemic is like, if everybody was just getting, you know, if Bernie's sort of proposition of everybody gets $2,000 a month, like still isn't enough really, but I mean, it would mean something. You did that, like, I bet the economy would be doing a lot better. Like, everybody would be much more stable. You'd have less small businesses needing to close because they'd be like, well, cool, people are still buying from me. I can do shop online or whatever sort of temporary stuff. Well, you know, it's just so obvious who's lining whose pockets and why. At least to the three of us. I don't know why it's not obvious to everybody.
Well, it's a template, right? You know, the wealth disparity coupled with the lack of industrial jobs, coupled with the fact that the vast majority of us work service industry, you know, whether it's commercial or, you know, food industry, we're giving a service to somebody. You know, that it's manipulated us. You know, we're on the verge of being a third world country.
Oh, yeah.
And if the people in this country don't have the funds to be the gaping hole of consumerism that we've been for so long, those markets have to go somewhere else. And then we become a very elite, cheap, desperate, and hungry workforce.
Yeah.
So we'll start making fucking iPhones in Ohio eventually.
We're
going to
be chattel wearing Armani. Yeah.
Precisely.
I mean, that's, yeah.
Knock off Armani. It would cost too much to give us Armani.
Oh,
they'd never
do
it.
I mean, yeah, they would get us something that looked approximately like it and be like, well, the uniforms are really fancy, so just go into the death cave and produce the phones. The toxins are fine. Don't worry about it.
We've installed
suicide nets. Don't worry about it.
Get in the death cave.
But anytime I hear any politician contemporarily over the last few years talk about the middle class, it's like, well, there isn't one. Stop talking about it like it's there. You need to start actually addressing that there isn't really a middle class anymore. There are people who are barely tapping on whatever the glass ceiling below the middle class is. And then there's everybody who's barreled through and they're on the other side and they have no concerns about anything. But there's not a whole lot. There's not a whole lot in the middle.
Well, that's, you know, that's a tool for division as well, right? Because if you orchestrate a concept of a middle class, then you have a group of people who are bootlickers for the upper class because it feeds them. Right. And they feel completely comfortable with stepping on anyone who is, quote, beneath them. You know, the evolution of a strong middle class, unfortunately, is always coupled with an incredibly wide variety of oppressions against lower classes. You know, it's like, I'm trying not to be totally rude, but some guy living in a trailer, you know, in rural Georgia, mm-hmm. will have nothing, will get nothing, will have a hard, fucked up life, you know, with trials at every corner, but they can always sit back and say, well, I don't live in a project.
Right.
I'm not that person, you know? So, you know, these semantic gymnastics that we do, you know, there's dog whistles wrapped into that. And you're right. Your ears should perk up. Any motherfucker talking about the middle class is about to sell you some shit that doesn't work.
Yeah. 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 Cause to speak to any class is to speak to the existence and validity of a class system instead of saying,
precisely,
everybody deserves enough. Great job on La Chose Francaise Arbitraire. I think we got very French there for a little bit.
We started out hard with the French early in the question. So,
yeah. So, William, 3 points. Brandon, 2 points. And now, guys, it's time for the final topic. And I know that you just can't believe that we're already here. We're almost to the end of the game. I know you're both, you both look
very sad.
I'm going to
protest the end of this show.
I'm staying on. That's right. Yeah. We're staying on Zoom, Nate. Too bad.
I love the idea of this episode being like 9 hours long just because you will not go away.
We're,
and I'm like, okay,
out.
Well, cool.
They're just, I'll gonna be taking my clothes off too.
Hey, it'll probably work. I mean, I don't know.
It'll be shocking at the very least.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm excited. Start doing some yoga.
There you go.
So Brandon, I'm going to start with you for the final topic. Do you have a vague idea about the 1969 to 71 occupation of Alcatraz?
Man, I do not. That sounds like something that's at the tip of my brain, but I am not familiar with that any detail.
All right, do you want to make anything up? You got any wild ideas about what it could be?
My guess is that it would be anti-war protesters from San Francisco taking over the federal prison building and fending off whoever tried to take them out for 2 years.
All right. I like that. It's the right era. It's an ideal place to stake out. I'm into it. I mean, relatively speaking, it's closer to Vietnam than any other part of the country other than Hawaii. So, you know.
Also, people in San Francisco at that time were wild, man.
Oh, yeah.
Wild.
Like that, you know.
Swim on out there, protest it up. I love it. I love it. Okay, William, do you have a vague idea about the occupation of Alcatraz?
It's not vague. Actually, I had the privilege of going on a boat tour that discussed this in detail. It was an insurrection. I don't recall if it was a tribe or a tribal organization, but it was indigenous persons who occupied Alcatraz. And if I remember correctly, they held it for almost a week. And it was, you know, primarily exactly what you'd expect it to be. Treaty violations, stealing of land, etc. I mean, there's a whole laundry list of things to be mad about, you know, from that perspective.
Very good. Yeah, I mean, it was an occupation by 89 Native Americans and their supporters, who they took over Alcatraz from November 20th of 1969 all the way until June 11th of 1971. It was 19 months long that they had the at that time closed down prison under their occupation. The protest was led by Richard Oakes, Lenata Means, and others, and John Trudell was the spokesperson. Really amazing, because they were basically saying, so under the Treaty of Fort Laramie between the U.S. and the Lakota tribe, all of the federal land that was abandoned was returned to Native American. And they were like, well, you guys abandoned Alcatraz because you shut it down. So it's ours now. And all of these things are supposed to be ours. So we're taking it. And
a cogent argument that should rationally persist. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything that's been written down and signed should be upheld as like, well, yeah, you guys agree to this shit. So get over it. Which, I mean, I think this prompts maybe the conversation about the court declaration about Eastern Oklahoma that occurred recently.
Huzzah.
Yeah. Which is a huge and amazing thing to just think like, okay, cool. I don't even know how this actually shakes out. Like, how do you guys think this would shake out?
Such a surprise from Neil Gorsuch, right?
Like, oh yeah. I mean, honestly, like, he's been very surprising. At least this whole term, he's been.
I guess he's surprising. Just so literal, though, that the fact that it is written down and it's like, well, that's what it says. That
what? He's actually got a.
To our favor, right? Like, he can't see anything between the lines. It's all exactly what's written down. That's what he sees. Which is, it is very conservative often, but it's not the same type of conservative as Thomas or Scalia or Kavanaugh or those dudes.
Yeah, yeah. It's not the, oh, well, what they meant to write down was.
Right.
It's the, oh, this is actually what it says. So we have to go with that.
Right.
And I'm not going to interpret the other direction either. But it's crazy.
He has a long history of fighting for indigenous rights, which I think Team Trump may have overlooked somehow or thought there was something more odious about his reputation that attracted them. But I found that surprising, too. But apparently this is something he has passionately fought for. And this was his opportunity to really do something. And, you know, you're right to bring it up. It's massive, you know, and, you know, the idea that this country would finally cede, and it's just administrative power, right? They don't have the ability to run people out of East Oklahoma, you know, all that history, you know, all that scare tactic nonsense is going on. It's administrative rights, you know, so they do get to make the decisions about what happens in those cities, you know, city planning, what happens to the resources. That's the big win, is that, you know, you're talking about a group of people, you know, for whom the environment is a core value.
Yeah.
In stark contradiction to the, you know, the government in Oklahoma presently.
Yeah, where earthquakes now happen a lot because of an overabundance of fracking. Things like that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's phenomenal, and it's wild because it's one of these, like, I mean, honestly, like, this year has been so insane just from top to bottom, and we're only midway through, but that in the same year that all of this horrible shit is happening, that you would get that sort of Supreme Court decision to say, hey, technically all of this land belongs to you guys. And very literally it does, and it's yours. You know, we'll see what the real, you know, resonant outcomes are. I mean, I'm sure it's not gonna, you know, it's gonna be appealed, and there's gonna be all sorts of other crap that happens and whatever, because there's a lot of garbage people who are gonna say, well, I live in, you know, wherever, Oklahoma, and I don't want to be, I'm not a Native American now just because you said so, because they don't understand how things work, and that's goes back to our legacy of American ignorance.
So that same court that made that phenomenal decision, like, 2 weeks later, said that a poll tax down in Florida was they didn't say it was completely legal. They decided against hearing it,
means it's in place. Yeah.
At least until the election. So,
right.
You know, it's same court.
Disenfranchises, what, a million people?
Yeah.
Something like that. I mean,
yeah, they had to do something to counteract the
good they were doing.
Because Florida passed the thing about the formerly incarcerated people being able to vote, right?
Well, that's what it is. It's
to put a tax on that. That's right.
Okay. It's making them pay their fees, their court fees, before they're allowed to vote.
Right.
But some of those fees are, like, you know, crazy amounts of money. These people who have been imprisoned and probably have trouble getting jobs. People from the working class, et cetera, are more likely to be imprisoned and over-policed, et cetera. So, and obviously from minority backgrounds as well. And so, yeah, it's effectively a poll tax because they're requiring them to pay all of these fees before they're allowed to vote. It's directly undermining that exact thing, which was a ballot measure, right? So the citizens of Florida wanted that to happen, and the conservatives are undercutting it as much as they can.
Which is weird, because you would think that they couldn't do that, but of course they always do. It's funny that's always kind of a thing, and that you know, a lot of these people probably were falsely imprisoned before trial and all sorts of things, and I'm sure that that's on the bill, right? Is they're like, right. Well, hey, we had to keep you in the courthouse for like 8 months before we even gave you a trial, and you couldn't post bail because we stacked that deck against you, but you have to pay for all the bills.
They have to be convicted felons, right? Definitely all sorts of problems with that, and all the people who take plea deals because they're railroaded into it and they can't really afford, you know, to wait around. It's all the scare tactics, etc. But to have your voting rights taken from you, you do have to be a convicted felon. I believe that that's true.
Right.
William, is that true?
Yes, sir. It is.
Right.
That, you know, and you know, the other side of that coin is that, you know, just like Nate mentioned, they can kind of keep you in stasis pretty much for as long as they want to. So, you know, that's another tactic, is, you know, you get someone wrapped up in the system just enough to keep them out of the way, you know, and you may drop the charges later, or you may not get a full grand jury conviction, but you have marred that person. You've, you know, given them financial hardships. You know, that's one of the things that's really scary about the way the government is handling these protests is, you know, on paper, it's, you know, we're getting people off the streets that are breaking stuff. Okay. The problem is the long-term effect of that is that you now have someone who's been processed through the system. You don't escape from that. You know, I've never been arrested. I got fingerprinted for a Nevada gaming license when I was 17 years old. You know, I'm in the fucking system, even though I've tried so hard to stay out of it. You know, and that follows you your whole life, you know, whether it's some, you know, fucking honky ass white passing a law that says you got to pay exorbitant fees, you know. And I always love those guys who are like, oh, it's no big deal, you just have to get your ID. And it's like, man, have you been to the DMV? It's an ordeal when you have your shit together and you have the time to do it, right?
Right. And then there's always a way to fine print away the type of ID that you issue as the valid version. Like, oh, well, actually, you needed to have a federal ID, so you need to bring a passport. I'm sorry that you brought your state ID or your driver's license. We needed something more formal.
It costs more, like a passport.
Yeah. And one last thought to jump back to sort of the Supreme Court composition, because I was talking to my wife about this the other day, and I think it's really interesting. But it's crazy to me how different conservatism has become just between appointing Roberts to now, where, you know, Roberts is somehow leading a moderate court as this guy who's like kind of not super shitty on purpose, because it's you know, for all of the horrible stuff that George W. Bush did and continues to have, you know, left us with, There was a nature to what being a conservative was that was just different, and it's metamorphized so much, you know, between him and Kavanaugh, say, where it's, you know, or even really between him and Scalia for that matter. Like,
I feel like it's people. Just been boiled down to its essence, you know.
that's a good point. Yeah,
the veneer is off.
They're not pretending anymore. Exactly.
They're not pretending.
It's like the weed in Colorado. It's just really potent because they're just focusing on making it right.
I'm glad that Roberts is performing this role as this swing vote. I think that there is some kind of integrity to the man where he doesn't want to be seen as a tool of just Trumpism and the devolution of American politics. You know, he's not dumb, but he's also not somebody who I would really trust either.
Oh no, he's not. He's certainly not a stand up and lead the resistance person, but he's could be just sort of self-interested enough to hold back our impending doom.
He's got to worry about what his legacy is going to be.
I was just going to say, it's a lifetime appointment, and we change presidents every 4 years. You know, I think about that a lot. My dad, like I said, was in the Air Force, and, you know, I have friends that I grew up with that went straight into the military, you know, right after high school. And, you know, I think about that a lot, how jarring it would be to know that you have a 20-year career, potentially five different presidents during that career, and every single time one gets elected, you could have a completely different mission statement thrown at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, which is wild because you go in with one set of intentions and you end up having to go through a period of time where you're told to do the opposite thing or something that you completely disagree with. Jeez. Well, hey, great job on the occupation of Alcatraz. I'm going to give William 2 points and Brandon 1 point. And the game's over, guys. I have no! final scores for you. I want to be...
Hell no, we won't go. What do we want? More vague idea. When do we want it now?
No Ragolia, no peace.
Well, all right. I guess we could do another...
we'll bonus round. Bonus round. Do it.
So yeah, unfortunately, as is the thing that happens with the scoring of points, one of you is won and one of you is lost. But the one of you who lost is not a loser. I want to emphasize that. We don't have losers here. We
just the second place winner. Didn't win.
Yeah, you just didn't win first.
That's
you got
fine.
You got to win the second time.
I'm a dad. I've espoused that propaganda myself.
Oh, yeah, man. I feel yeah. you.
So yeah, Brandon, you scored 12 points and you came in second place. So great job. Thank you for playing. Do you have anything that you'd like to plug this week? Anything you want people to know about? Anything you want people to do? Anything like that? Keeping in mind, this episode will probably come out around mid to late August.
Well, this isn't time sensitive because it was published in October. Everybody buy my book, Lars Briggs Face Werewolf in Space from Space Boy Books.
It's an amazing book. William, have you read this book? Have you checked it out?
I have not, to my detriment.
We're gonna have to get you a copy of that because it's fucking amazing. I got to edit, and I'm putting very loose quotes around edit because I did not do much. I got to enjoy reading it, and then I went, oh, he missed a comma here. Oh wait, I think this then is supposed to be the cool. We're good.
Well, I have been a copy editor for almost a decade. I would hope that I was mostly clean.
Oh yeah, no, I mean I appreciate the thoroughness, but it's also just like the wholly fleshed out vision of the book. I mean, it's just such a good story.
Thanks, man.
And I really I can't wait to see the next thing. You teased it. Are you working on it at all?
I'm teasing it with myself. I am working on some various things, fits and starts. You know, pandemic allows you a lot of time, but at the same time, it's, you know, an ever-present weight on all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I there's like a, oh, everything is desperate and horrible. And then for some reason, I'm like, hey, I got to get on a podcast and we're going to talk like nothing's going wrong for a few
minutes. It's nice.
So yeah. So nice. I feel you. I feel you on that. Great. So William, you scored 14 points, and woo! You have won
so close.
This week's episode.
So close.
It was a very close game. So William, do you have anything you would like to plug?
Yeah. First though, Brandon, I love signed copies, man. I'd gladly trade you once my books come in.
Fuck yeah, dude.
Awesome, dude. I'd love to send you one. Right. I have a book coming out actually just came out on the 4th of July. No irony at all. No. It was intentional.
It was very intentional.
Very intentional. Welcome to Spring Street, put out by Space Boy Books, our good friend, Mr. Nate Ragolia. And I had the honor of working with Sean Krakowski, as an editor. Please buy it. I wrote it in 2011 and had no fucking idea that the year it came out, it would actually be talking about the exact same things that we're dealing with right now. Except, you know, to mention that I may be a long-term cynic in that regard, and that I did not predict that things would get better, but certainly did not foresee the ways in which they got worse. Yeah. I have another book I've been working on. My timeline was a little longer for The Destruction of America, which, you know, is disappointing as an American, but also as an author. So I'm like, well, shit, man. This was a very negative connotation that I put into this book, and you guys fucking hyper-realized it before I could even put it out.
Man, imagine my book where I'm like, hey, all this technology and some of this like socialist ideas sort of taking the mainstream means we'll be in a good place later. So
we need the hopeful stuff too, man.
Yeah,
we need the hopeful stuff.
We do. I was like, oh, I for sure thought we'd be closer to something by now than we are, and we've just been moving the other direction. So
yeah, we have.
Yeah.
That's a good point though, right? The hope is important, right? Because it's very 1990s to point your finger and look down on things. David Foster Wallace was a big proponent of this. It takes a lot more courage, to point out what you think the right thing is, because it's easy to wag your finger at all the things that are wrong, but unless you're, producing some sort of alternative, then you're really just fucking asking for the manager, right?
Oh yeah. Well, and I think to that point, I mean, one of the things that's great about Welcome to Spring Street is that you, despite all of the, despite the darkness that's in there in the way that that there's oppressive government, you really latch on to these smaller communities of people and how groups of people who are all outsiders can link up to create a really powerful support system that it has its own, mobility and its own sort of hope and potential. I mean, that's kind of what we always need. And I think, part of the truncated aspect of the American dream is the idea that it's that you're going to get all these things. But really, the only thing that works about the American dream over time is that you can hope to fix something. You can hope to make something better. And that's why, I think all three of us would agree, and many of our listeners would agree, that like the contention here is that the whole American promise and dream has been abandoned by the administration that we're currently under, because they're not about making anything better. They're cynically saying, how do we strip mine the most out of what's left and walk away so that we're enriched and everybody else, who cares? Because it doesn't matter to us. It's basically the most cynical, most like just nihilistic sort of interpretation of how running a country could be.
That's absolutely true. I would only caution that I don't think that we can say it started in 2017.
No, absolutely. You're very right.
For a long time, but yeah, it's just getting worse. And this administration has latched onto that as a virtue, right?
It's been very galvanized, yeah. Because Nixon and Reagan were doing the same thing. I mean, Reagan ushered in the cynicism in the greatest degree, which was to package the cynicism in a smile and act like that. Oh yeah, well no, just buying stuff and wanting to be a stockbroker is the best thing that we could do.
Greed is good.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks for taking some time out of your evenings. I know it's later there than it is here. So I appreciate the time, and I hope you both had a good time and that you'd be willing to come back, because I will have you back on the show. It'll probably be in the Zoom format.
I have a vague
for a
idea
while.
About a number of things. So
well, great. I mean, we can do something way more silly and less. Do something a little less thoughtful and depressing-ish. I don't know. It's not really depressing. No. It's just sort of the, anyway. Well, yeah, we'll do something else different at some point. But yeah, I'll have both of you back on.
The hopeful thing, that the not depressing thing about this is that we were talking about the people who are fighting back. That's a good thing.
It's true. Yeah, because the only depressing thing is that no one would fight back.
Yes.
Or pretend that nothing was wrong. That's
right.
That's the danger right now. Everyone who's pretending like everything is okay, on a deeper level, that when this virus is tamped down to a controllable level, the fantasy of returning exactly to where we were in January 2020, like that's the danger. And getting as many people as possible to wake up to the fact that shit was not okay, prior to this. That's the goal. And I hope when this airs in August, we've made more strides in that direction, because it's literally how we are going to keep from becoming a totalitarian dictatorship.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, the number of people I talk to, and granted the circles I'm running in are going to be a certain way, but most people, even regardless, I guess, because I've talked to some high school friends who are much more conservative, who everybody agrees that it's like, it's amazing to be off of the hamster wheel that we were on, right? That even for the uncertainty and for all this stuff, like there's something exciting and invigorating about having a different level of control about your day-to-day life.
Yes.
Now, a lot of it is total lack of control too. And that's where this disparity comes in, but the idea that we're thinking about it. I mean, I've also talked to a lot of people who either are, you know, management and businesses or whatever. Anybody I talk to says there's absolutely no way we're bothering with offices after this. We've lost, you know, people talk about we've lost 10 to 15% productivity by having people work at home. It costs us so much more to rent office space. We're not doing it. Things will change. Things are going to change one way or the other. The big question, I think, is what we do with that change and how we make it work. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I thank you both because I know you guys will be fighting it and I'm going to be fighting it. Like we all have to be out there saying, hey, no, we don't have to continue to build highways and just kind of do this, you know, car-based commute life where we just consume a bunch of resources to have the auspices of an order that used to exist just because.
Well, and it's not order, right? It's chaos, man. Yeah, if you can't muster the time and energy to learn about what's going on in the world because you're so worried about the next workday, then that they won. And I think that's, you know, the 1-2 punch of, you know, this insurrection against white supremacy in this country, coupled with, you know, the virus happening, did something that hasn't been available for a long time. You know, it's allowed people to really get in the streets like you would see, you know, in a former Soviet bloc country, you know, or in Asia. You know, the massive protests that are necessary to pull this sort of thing off. But that's just it. You hit it on the head. It's a hamster wheel, right? Like, I can't go get arrested at a protest. I got to go to work tomorrow or we all fucking starve. I have a meeting, exactly.
Right.
You know, so that space has kind of inadvertently been opened. And I think I'm proud that the people in this country have taken to the streets and sustained this, you know, given that opportunity. You know, Ferguson had to tamp down rather rapidly, even though it had just about as much energy as what's going on now. And that was the primary reason is you can't just quit your job in a capitalist society. You're going to starve and they don't fucking care.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that really is it. I mean, if we didn't have a pandemic, George Floyd probably would have died and everybody would have been upset for 2 weeks and then it would have been over with.
Unfortunately.
You know? Yeah. And so now's the time. Now's the time for us to do what we can and to keep pressing. So hopefully we all will. Hopefully we've been pressing up until the release of this episode.
Incessantly.
Incessantly.
Yeah. Take their property and never go away. That's the magical, that's the right way to protest, right?
Yes.
Bonus point.
That's right.
Yeah, he already won. I don't need to give him a bonus point now. We don't need to put a hat on a hat here. Thank you guys again. Listeners, if you like this show, please subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen. That helps us out. You know, or just tell some people. Tell people you know. Do you like this? Tell people you like that you like this. Don't tell people you don't like because they probably won't like this. There's a good chance. And then they're going to write me angry emails or something, and I don't really have time for that. Otherwise, you can follow us on social media. You know how to look up a vague idea on the various platforms. We exist in those places. I trust your Googling skills. Otherwise, Black lives continue to matter. So keep supporting. Keep supporting indigenous populations as they deal with COVID and as they just deal with existing as an oppressed entire community in this country that we don't talk about at all unless a football team is changing their name, which hopefully will be a good name by the time this episode comes out. I'm interested to see what they go with. We all had a vague idea about protesting, and that's a good thing because the devil is in the details. Bye-bye.
Sweet. Awesome, man.
A Vague Idea is written and produced by me, Nate Regolia, with Shannon Page and sometimes John Perros. Information about topics often come from Wikipedia, so hey, why not donate a bit to that? Sound effects are Creative Commons public domain. If you like this podcast, tell a few people, and subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen. And if you happen to like reading science fiction, check out the small press I started with my friend Sean Brokowski. You can find Spaceboy books at readspaceboy.com.